And welcome to another edition of the Odyssey Radio Show. I'm your host, Mike Schultz. Tonight, we'll be talking about ancient mysteries and metaphysical topics, and specifically the ancient astronaut Ceri. I've invited an expert on the subject to the show. He's affiliated with Zachariah Sitchin, who, of course, is one of the leading researchers in the field. So welcome to the show, Eric Parker.
Thank you very much, Mike. I'm glad to be back again.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to have you back because there's so much material. Why don't we start out by summarizing the ancient astronaut theory, and we'll take it from there.
Well, basically, it is the theory that throughout the thousands of years of civilization and the thousands of years or even scores of thousands of years before that, Earth was visited, and the sightings where Earth was visited from beings from other planets, intelligent beings like us who could think, rationalize, and build technology. But most of those sightings were misidentified. And many of them have come down in the form of the god stories, or maybe giant stories, or great monsters and other things like this. There is a lot of evidence to support this theory that a lot of misidentifications have become part of our history now.
Absolutely. Now, in the 1970s, a researcher was able to translate some ancient tablets named Zachariah Sitchin. Why don't you tell us a bit about that and how you became affiliated with him?
Okay, well, the translation of these tablets, which were found in Mesopotamian area, Iraq, Syria, other parts of the area between Tigris and Euphrates rivers, are tablets that are either carved into clay or into stone. So the tablets that were found are the originals. They have been coming up for about 120 to 30 years right now, and they've been working on translations that whole time. There was a major breakthrough in the beginning of the 1900s when they discovered, when some of the British researchers discovered the flood tablet, which just told of the story of the flood like they were familiar with from the Bible.
Sure.
When Zachariah came around and did his research, which was about 10 to 20 years of research plus 10 years and 20 years of writing and correlating all of it, he came to find out that some of the mistranslations or the way that they looked at them was pre-modern age, pre-technology age. And when you looked at it with a modern view, what was being described was fantastic and pretty revolutionary in the terms of more technology than we were familiar with at the time. Now it doesn't seem so strange. So these gods that are flying around or doing things that seem like miracles or using weapons that seem like laser blasters and such like this, they couldn't fathom that before the modern era that came after World War II. So when Zachariah looked at it, he noticed that these things were telling more of a story that was possibly based in truth than fantasy.
Okay, so now we know I know traditional researchers say that this is all mythology. Are there a lot of other experts who have come on the side of Zachariah Sitchin and are supporting his thesis?
Well, there is many scholars now that are coming out, and it's like the paradigm is shifting. But if you're talking to somebody from the old guard, the old paradigm, whose basis of research or their funding was based on keeping the official line of the history that they wanted to promote, those type of people would not endorse any theory at all anywhere on this earth that included anything outside of the earth, except for, let's say, studying meteors, that kind of thing, a geologist. But as far as people studying society or history, they would not include anything from outside of the planet. So there is a big problem because a lot of the evidence is either ignored, put on the back, put in a drawer, and never talked about because it does not conform to a standard theory.
Absolutely. Now let's talk a little bit about the Bible. Are there some clues in there that perhaps there were many gods in the Old Testament and not just one? Can you talk about that?
Well, sure. I mean, that's the basis of the Old Testament is itself the God of the Bible, who we call Yahweh, his fight to convince his people, the Israelites, that he was the one true God to worship and to give up all their false gods. And the whole Bible is the fact that they don't give up these false gods and other gods. He gets mad. He punishes them. He gives them another chance, and it repeats itself. So Yahweh goes to war against the Egyptian gods, in a way, when they're in Egypt during the story, and then later on the Canaanite gods, and it seems to be a battle of the dominance of ideology and also worship. So there is other gods mentioned in the Bible. But the funny thing is that a lot of those stories were borrowed, and they borrowed them from the culture that had many gods in them.
Right. Are there any exact references to other gods in the Old Testament?
Any
other, or has it all been deleted?
Well, they changed some of the words in Hebrew to make a plurality out of the word God. So in Hebrew, the strict grammar and text of the word is plural, yet they translate in English as a singular Lord or God. But there is other gods mentioned, because there's other priests of other gods mentioned. One was coming to talk about it against Yahweh to Moses, and his tongue was turned, and then he became somebody who was pro-Yahweh. There was other priests of other gods that different prophets went up against and challenged them. The stories are all over the place. There's especially in the Old Testament, before they go into the land of Israel, they end up seeing giants there, and they worship other gods, and they go back into the desert after that.
Sure, but there appears to be two main gods, one who's helpful and benevolent, and one who's more of a taskmaster type of god. Why don't you talk about those two characters?
Well, what happens is you get the characteristics of all the prior multiple gods, like the birth mother and the harvesting god and the goddess of the rain and floods and war. All of those become combined into a single monotheistic character that's the Yahweh of the Bible. So any previous attribute that a god had was given to Yahweh. So he then became, by the way, this was a copy of what Marduk did 2,000 years earlier in Babylon. When he took over, Marduk also took all the aspects of all the other gods and changed their names to his name. So Yahweh of the Bible becomes the birth goddess, or the mother goddess, the father god, the god of war, the god of rain and harvesting and punishment, and all the attributes are combined into one character.
Right. Now let's talk about Enki, who was associated with the snake in the Garden of Eden.
Well, Enki's symbol, and Enki is an epitaph, it's his title, it means Lord of Earth in a male form, so male Lord of Earth. So we really may not even know what his real name is, and in different cultures he had other names. But he was a chief engineer, and his symbol was the entwined serpent, two snakes, which does today stand for the medical profession, and physicians use that. And Zechariah hypothesized that one of the reasons is the DNA, entwined DNA coding that Enki used in helping to create mankind. That's according to the story. So the mixture of their blood and what they were mixing, their blood and the clay and all these things, we think that's a DNA compilation. So Enki became the father to mankind in a way, and he loved mankind a lot. And he was very upset when the flood happened and a lot of people were killed, although his brother Enlil was one who did not like mankind as much. So
right.
They were always struggling over whether to favor mankind or to not favor mankind.
Now, somehow the character of Enki got twisted into the character of Satan in the Bible, didn't it, in a way, in the Garden of Eden story?
Well, here's what happens. When you have these older stories that have these dual characters and they're arguing with each other, one of them is going to be a positive or one of them is going to be a negative. In other words, so there's always a game, like somebody has to win and somebody has to lose. So these characteristics creep up because there's different things of the Bible that the God of the Bible does that were copied from what Enki, Ar, and Lil did. And Lil is the one who allowed the flood to occur but not warn anybody. But Enki is the one who warned his favorite character, Noah, in the Bible, but in the oldest version his name was Utnapishtim and Ziasudra. He names his character he gives him the information that the flood will occur and tells him to build a vessel and take his family and escape. So yeah, you get a sort of situation where at one time one of them is maybe helping to kill off mankind or not helping to stop it, and one of them is favoring it a little bit but not completely. And these characteristics get mixing up when the stories come down later.
Right. Well, it appears that the Roman church needed a bad guy to, keep everybody coming to church every Sunday, so Enki was perhaps a good candidate.
Well, do you want to know another source for the Satan?
Sure.
In the Egyptian mythology or in Egyptian history, Osiris and his brother Seth were fighting, and Seth killed Osiris, and he became the first Satan. Isis, the wife of Osiris, put Osiris back together piece by piece from all the different corners of Egypt, and then impregnated herself. And she had the baby with a fatherless child, impregnated, and her son became, his symbol became the solar disk, the sun, and he was the son of Isis, and he went to avenge his father's death. Seth, who we think is the first Satan because of the sounding of the words. It seems to have an old source there. And the Osiris-Isis-Seth myth is at least to 2500 BC or older.
And then there's the mythology of the god Pan with the cloven hoofs and, you know, the god of wine, music, and song. And somehow that got twisted as well into it.
See, Pan is an example of a character who's half man, half animal. The Sumerians left so many depictions of these type of characters. Some of them times are translated as either monsters or mythological things that the hero has to compete against to earn some valor. But there also seem to be remnants of a memory of the creation process of mankind that didn't go so well in the beginning. There was mistakes made, and so they didn't get a perfect model right away. So these depictions, we think, may have been some of these early models, half man, half beast, before they got a good mixture that worked well. This text talk at length about the different problems that each generation or version had. The final version that was their one that they came out with, they called his name Adama, like Adam of the Bible. Adama was the name of the first model man.
Right. Now, I've puzzled over and over these half-man, half, you know, human, half-animal creatures. Is there any skeletal evidence, or is it just too far back to support
this idea? You know, I haven't seen any skeletal evidence of those kind of combined beast human characters, but there is something that Zechariah and I are trying to chase down with the skeletons of a Anunnaki princess that was found in the Royal Cemetery of Ur, and her headdress was so big that it just, if it was put together properly, this woman, I mean this princess, would have had a gigantic head. Supposedly the skeleton is in the British Museum. So we're going to be trying to get some access to that over the next couple of years and see if we can actually do some measurements of that.
Well, call us when you do.
Oh, sure.
Now, because the Egyptians left behind so many pictures of these half, for instance, half crocodile, and or half bird, half human, could it be that these were the characteristics of the gods, like perhaps the god could fly, so it would be pictured as a bird human?
That's absolutely correct. That's what they did. They used that double meaning to depict what their attribute was. And there was a lot of other things that the Sumerians and other ancient Mesopotamians depicted, like sometimes a fish outfit was depicted on somebody whose job was involved in the waters, if he was doing something in the ocean. You mentioned the flying things, the wings a lot. There's a lot of these type of things going on. And the Egyptians used to really love the combination of the animal head and the human body.
Right.
I mean, it was just, they really embellished that motif.
It's replete with artwork.
That's correct.
So, for instance, Anubis, the god of the underworld, was a jackal. Maybe he was more of an aggressive type of god or something.
I definitely would not want to run into Anubis when I go.
It's pretty scary.
Yeah.
Now, I have to ask you at this point, what about David Icke's theory of shape-shifting, that these gods had the ability to, you know, were reptiles and could appear as humans? What do you think of that?
Well, I followed David Icke for a long time, and I've seen him speak before. Unfortunately, there is really no physical evidence behind what he's talking about. You can't record in an ancient text or tablet somebody doing this. Now, I've looked over literally thousands to multiple thousands of depictions of ancient things on rocks and stones and who knows what from countless sorts of books. I can't find any reptilian images, not one of them. The only even thing that's close to reptilian is these characters, the Ubaikian characters that were, we think, robotic beings that had, like you could give them instructions. And there's some motifs of that with the slanted eyes a little bit. But overall, everything that I find is not showing the reptilian thing, and I have tried to find the data myself. I've even looked into the original sculptures of the mother goddesses where they don't even have features, just kind of round lumps, and as far back as we have archaeology for. And there's just nothing that is reptilian. Whenever they depict the gods, they depict humanoid. We look like them.
Exactly. Now, what do you make of all of the Eastern legends from the Nagas, the half-reptiles that descended from the sky in India, and the dragon gods of China? What do you make of that mythology?
Well, first of all, dragon mythology is so less like some of the oldest characters of that I can find in the archaeological record of depictions of demons and scary beasts and things that scared them. I mean, there was one called Lashtu, I think it was, and that was attributed to women who had miscarriages. So if you had a miscarriage, they thought that demon came and stole the baby, things like this. These motifs are so old in history that it doesn't surprise me that they show up in the literature. And there also could be possibly a mistranslation. But also, there's another possibility that there's been multiple different groups visiting Earth over thousands, actually millions of years, that we've been a great, wonderful planet. I mean, this is a wonderful planet. We have so much water. We have hundreds of millions of species of plant life, animal life, insect life. We are just a smorgasbord. for any being that's just flying around and wants to stop off and have a swim, you know, or get supplies. So it wouldn't shock me if one group that came here was reptilian and they made an impression on the local people and they remembered the story and wrote it down. But there's no evidence to back it up.
Even, it's funny, the Knights Templar, when they were looking into the Temple of Solomon, they were replete with dragon mythology in all of their uniforms. I mean, it's just so odd.
Yeah.
Where do you think it came from?
Well, the dragon mythology is some of the oldest that there is. Gilgamesh fights a dragon and defeats him. Well, we call it a dragon, but, it's, you know, that's just our modern word for it. This is just the common, you know, it's a beast with wings.
Uh-huh.
So it's so common that it doesn't surprise me that one group picked up the motif and used it for their symbols. Remember, whatever groups were around back then were all picking the symbols that they would use to represent them. And dragons are strong and scary and powerful and the whole thing. And if you have a dragon on your side, well, then maybe you even have the god's favor on your side. So to depict a dragon would be to try to ward off the evil spirit that you don't want it to hurt you and to get favor with it.
I see. Now, let me run a theory by you. The Knights Templar, they were in Jerusalem for 9 years, and they dug down there, and they found something extremely important. Now, I believe what they found was evidence of multiple gods, of the Anunnaki, and the church desperately wanted this suppressed. We know they became extremely powerful after this discovery. What do you think of this theory?
Well, first of all, it's possible. Now, you're saying that what they discovered was evidence of the Anunnaki. I'm a little bit closer to the Da Vinci Code theory that they found evidence that the Jesus story had secrets that were not disclosed. So some of the information could destroy the main theme of the Christianity. Remember, at the beginning of Christianity, all these groups were arguing for dominance, and the Roman Catholic version is just the version that won hundreds of years later down the road. In the first 300-400 years before the Council of Nicaea, there were major groups that had completely different philosophies because they contradicted each other in some cases. So I think what they found was evidence of one of these other philosophies of the story of Jesus, which would ruin the church's story. As opposed to now, that could be evidence of Anunnaki for all I know.
Okay, I mean, do you think that he or his progeny survived the crucifixion and went off to live with Mary Magdalene? I mean, is that what you think the big secret was?
Let me put it to you this way. Doesn't every gospel say that Jesus survived the resurrection and appeared? Where they differ is on what happened after he reappeared. One story says he just went up into light. Another one says they met him later on some city, I forget right now, and they met him 3 days later and they pinched him. Each story has a different ending, but in every version he survives. So why do we think that he died? He was either healed magically by God, or if there is truth of these ancient astronauts and he was somehow involved with them, they could have cured him with advanced techniques of medicine. Maybe he cured himself through meditation and prayer. But the point is, every gospel says he survived. Why is it so hard to believe that he did survive?
So this is another possibility for the big secrets of the Knights Templar. It could be both. It could be that they discovered all of this information.
Absolutely. They may have gotten the treasures of the world at the time. Who knows? They definitely had something over the church for a long time.
Now tell me what you believe the Anunnaki looked like. Describe them and how they acted and a little bit about how society worked back then.
Well, it's funny. What I believe they look like is just me telling you what the depictions look like. They are so clear. If anybody wants to check on my website, which is ericparker.com, I have some pictures that are, you know, authentic photographs from museum pieces that are 5 or 6 feet high that show Anu, the king of heaven, when he came down, and he came for a state visit, and he's there with his wife Antu, and they're being serviced by human attendants. When they show these Anunnaki gods, they usually have beards, the males. They are tall, maybe 8 to 10 feet tall. They sit on a throne seat, and they're usually elevated, and they're usually the same height as anybody standing next to them. They almost always have, like, curly, well, the Assyrian and Sumerian had curly-style hair. They were always humanoid-looking, and we actually were created to look like them. It was not as surprising that we came out the way we did. Also, according to Zachariah's theories, they evolved and became sentient in this solar system with us. This is not a species who came from, or you know, a group of people that came from a different planet way out there. He believes that they grew up on Nibiru. They only grew up ahead of us by a snap of my fingers if you compare the age of the universe, 450,000 years or so ahead of us. It's not that much in cosmic time.
Now, but they believe in a supreme God of the universe, correct?
They did have a theory of the supreme being of all, yes, the supreme creator of all.
Right. So Anu, who's on the home planet, is not to be confused with the supreme creator of the universe.
That's correct. They were not claiming to be the creators. They were only claiming to be, in relationship to us, our gods, because they helped create us when they needed to have workers, and because we did treat them as gods, and it worked for them. It made sense for them. There was no reason to dispute it. It favored them.
Mm-hmm. Now, the supreme mineral of wealth on this planet has always been gold. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Well, Zacharias figured out that what the Anunnaki actually came for was mineral resources, and the prime resource was gold. He speculates that they had dwindling heat in their atmosphere. Heat was dissipating because the planet's far away and doesn't come close to the sun for much of its orbital period. So they had a theory of spraying gold dust in the atmosphere as a conductor, and who knows, possibly charging it, maybe just the fact that it's up there would create something with a magnetic field up their planet alone and help retain heat. They wanted to create a greenhouse gas situation like we want to avoid. They wanted to create that. So he thinks that they mined gold first in the Persian Gulf, which was not successful, then later on in Africa, which was extremely successful, and there is evidence of very ancient mines in Africa. Sometimes they attribute it to King Solomon, but that's not long enough. Some of these are 100,000-year-old mines, they think. I mean, that's the information that the professionals are coming back with. Who was around at 100,000 years old to mine these minerals? Well, they think it was primitive man, but at that time, there's no civilization of needing those minerals. So it's unlikely, but... So it seems like the Anunnaki in Africa, that was before the flood. And after the flood, they moved their gold operations to Central and South America.
I see. Now, tell me, there's all these remnants of heavy, stone blocks and all of these pyramids. How do you think these blocks were made? In my research, I see evidence of advanced drilling and precision cuts. What do you think?
Well, we see evidence in depictions of little guys that are in mining outfits that have these tools. And in a place called Atlantis in Tolan in Mexico, they have these giant Atlantean beings, and they have these instruments that they're depicted with. There's other depictions from Mesopotamia as well. I have seen the most incredible structures that are so humongous of single stone pieces that are, I'm 5'10", whatever, 200 pounds. These pieces are 20, 30 times bigger than me. I've been to Egypt,
right.
I've been in the pyramids, I've been to Malta, and I've seen the pictures from Baalbek. I can't believe there would be any reason for humans to work with stones that are bigger than people's houses.
No.
It doesn't make sense, unless the technology is so advanced that you don't care about the size. Somehow the size is negated. That's what it seems like at Baalbek. These are these blocks that are in place, three of them, the triliton, above ground, not on the lower level, three levels up. First of all, why do they need stones that gigantic? How did they move them? And we know where they came from because the quarry is a mile and a half away in Baalbek, and there's still a brick sticking out of the ground. 30 people can stand in front of this one stone.
Right,
okay,
that's from Lebanon, yeah.
So my theory is that somehow they were able to negate the effect of gravity and lift the stone up easier. Now, did they do it with magnetics? Did they do it with vibrations? Did they do it with chanting, meditation, taking it out of phase with this time frame? I don't know. But the evidence is that they were able to accomplish it and very well. All over the world.
Is,
I mean, all over the ancient world, there are these fantastic, gigantic stone structures that are not possible for us to build today. The Great Pyramid is, all of the Great Pyramids, the top three, are examples that we can't do today.
And that makes a lot of sense. Now, there's also obelisks all over Egypt to this day. Why don't you explain what an obelisk is? And they're very heavy as well.
An obelisk is the top of the pyramid, okay? And I'm sorry, You're talking about the tall obelisks. The ones I've seen, like, I think Karnak, I'm sorry, they're like 50 to 60 feet tall. You're talking about the,
The Aswan one was never completed, but it's 1,000 tons.
Yeah. I've seen a theory on how they lifted them, and I'm actually favoring that theory because it does make sense. In the context, it doesn't explain how they built the pyramids, but it explains that when they built these obelisks sideways on the ground, they were able to raise them with different methods, and they had an A-frame, and they would put sand under one end, and they would have a counterweight. They may have used kites. I've seen a theory that could explain how some of them were in place, but it doesn't explain the gigantic structures, especially the Great Pyramid, with 480 feet high in the air, and the stones are, you know, 30 feet long.
Do you think the obelisks represented?
Well, the ancient motif of something standing straight up, see, the professional archaeologists would say it's a phallic symbol. That, we think, is not correct. We don't think they were, you know, celebrating that. What we think they were doing was emulating what they saw the gods doing. Now, there's many stories in the ancient texts about divine birds or blackbirds, shields of fire, these things that these gods traveled in, the vimanas of the Indian fame. So when these things took off, and we believe they used fuel-based rockets because some of the platforms of stone have charring on them, like extreme heat, and that's what the giant stones were used for, to protect people on the outside from the exhaust. And Gilgamesh actually reports seeing a rocket launching and describes it. So we think these obelisks and other, you know, these cone-shaped objects are emulating what they saw the gods doing, which was launching, we think, rockets, of course, into outer space.
Sure.
Well, rockets and other technology. It's
right.
Possible that they were using fuel-based, but they may have had other type of fuels that we don't know about. Zechariah had hypothesized about a water-based fuel that they could use when they were in outer space, for example, as a weapon. Since a water-based weapon would actually become ice instantly, it could shatter a meteor, possibly, if it's enough force, or something, an asteroid that would be in the way.
Now, Zechariah has a new book. It talks about 2012 and the Mayan calendar. Why don't you talk a bit about his theories in this subject?
Sure. Zechariah's latest book is called The End of Days, Armageddon and Prophecies of the Return. What he did was compile a huge assortment of ancient texts that describe the coming of the Messiah, the end of days when the gods will return, when the end of the world, and all these things. People are most usually aware of, for example, the revelations, you know, in the New Testament, in the book of Revelations, and so that's kind of the theme that we're talking about. So the Mayan calendar is a gigantic count of time, and there's an ending of a great cycle that's going to end in 2012, okay? There's two factors, though, in calculating this number. First of all, the 2012 is really the ending of one giant cycle of time, okay, that could be, which is the 13th Baktun, that's what it's called, and if you divide the number of days by the actual solar year, 365 and a quarter, you get the year 2012. But there's an author who believes you need to divide it not by 365 and a quarter, but by the calendar's 360-day perfect mathematical system, which would give you a returning date of 2087, or the end of that cycle of time.
It could be either, huh?
Well, and if you go for 2087, that's exactly 5,200 years on the dot. If you go with the 2012 date, you have a 5,125 years. We're only talking a difference of a very small amount of time when you're calculating literally several million days.
But to us, it's important.
It's important. So the cycle of time is going to end, and the new cycle is going to begin. What will be happening on Earth when the new cycle begins and the ending of the old cycle? These questions have always scared mankind. At the end of every millennium, these are the kind of things that have been going on. And that's what Zechariah's book talks about. It talks about how everything that we think we're going on right now is new to us is really not new to us. All of these things are repeating history. And, you know, when you see it like this, it's hard to argue with the facts because the ancient texts are valid, real data that we have and we acquire. And they're in museums, and anybody could see them anywhere. You know, if they go and research it, they can see them for themselves.
Right. Now, the interview is winding down. I have a few more questions about the Anunnaki and giants. My first question is, in 3000 B.C. in Egypt, we know they were very prominent. They were interacting with mankind. Mm-hmm. But by 1000 B.C., the Anunnaki had receded into the background. What do you think happened there?
Well, Zechariah says they actually did leave. He gave some reasons why they left. They may have left because their mission was accomplished. They may have left because mankind was becoming too numerous for them, since they were a very small number. They may have left because their natural time cycle was being affected by living on Earth, which is a very fast planet that zips around the sun every 365 and a quarter days. If they came from a planet with a 3,600-year orbit or anything longer than ours, time would seem to go really fast for them. So Zechariah is convinced that, yes, they did in fact leave. And all of these prophecies are always been about the return. When will they come back? What will the signs be? What will it look like? What will be happening? What will we do? What are we supposed to do? You know?
So do you or he feel that a few of them stayed in contact with secret societies throughout the ages?
I think there's some evidence of that, but I'm not sure of the scope. Because I research other cases as well, that could influence my feeling. I'm not sure what Zachariah's opinion is on this. He does say that it's possible some stayed behind and basically were isolated. I know the princess, the one that died in Ur, is one of those we think stayed behind. And right. There was some kind of quote about one god that wanted to stay behind, a goddess. And she was already older than her grandfather. She was the granddaughter, but she was older than her grandfather by the time the Anunnaki left.
Right. It's just interesting that the secret societies for the past 200 years have been pushing a new world order, a one-world government, and I'm just wondering what's behind that, if the Anunnaki are possibly wanting control of the planet again.
Well, check this out. If you have a secret society and you know that the God stories are misidentified alien stories, in other words, there is astronauts from other planets and we're interacting with them, then you would also realize that we have to become a unified planet to be dealing with these other people off of different planets. We can't have different governments and different countries negotiating independent treaties with an alien group. So I think that it's been misconstrued why the world government is necessary. Now, if the UN was stronger and more forceful, and if the UN president spoke for the world, it would be different. But that's just not the reality right now.
Right, exactly. One last topic. I want to touch on this kind of lost book of the Bible, the Book of Enoch. It seems to mention 200 Anunnaki that came down to Earth. Why don't you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, well, Enoch, the Book of Enoch, is one of those books that's not in the canonized version of the Bible, but yet we have a recording of it throughout history, and we have some long ancient language versions of it. And Enoch was mentioned in the Old Testament as somebody who walked with God, and he went up to Zechariah, and I think that he went up to the planet Nibiru where these gods lived in our solar system. And he was, you know, he was offered to, you know, learn a little bit, you know, fly and do whatever and learn whatever he could. There's many books that are mentioned in the Bible that are actually not available anymore, except in second-party versions, where, in other words, we don't have the trail of evidence to go back to see how ancient it is. The Book of Jubilees is one of them. It's mentioned in the Bible. So is a book called The Book of the Wars of Yahweh.
Right. The Apocrypha, sure.
Yeah. And so there's,
absolutely.
You know, I have a lot of books. Do you know about the Nag Hammadi Library? I mean, is it the Nag Hammadi that was found in Egypt in a well or in the underground? They found a huge collection of texts.
Right,
and
which seems to confirm all this information that you're talking about.
Most of the time it does confirm it. Basically, it confirms the simple theory that there was humans, our civilization was interacting with these beings, we call them angels, we call them the God, and they were telling humans to do this and to do that, and the humans were or were not, and if these things were not mythology and these stories were true, then that is just the reality of what occurred.
Right, well, that's the basic theory in a nutshell.
Yeah.
We're all out of time, actually. Why don't you give us your contact, your website, and your DVD info real quick, and then we'll have to move on.
ericparker.com, E-R-I-K-P-A-R-K-E-R, ericparker.com. And from my site, there is a video available, plus the link to Zachariah's site and some other sites. And I have slides available for anybody who wants to see, plus an article that they can read and get some more information from. ericparker.com.
Well, thank you so much. You're a fountain of information. Take care.
Thank you, Mike. Bye-bye.
Sure, bye-bye. Okay, that was Eric Parker. So check out his website, and he is always a fascinating guest. So I also have a few DVDs on ancient mysteries. The first is titled The Sands of Time, and my latest is called The Temples of Stone. And they're available through, if you click on Odyssey from the main website, or go to fountainsofuse.net. Either way, you can check out my DVDs, and they have lots of slides and pictures from all around the world. All the places we talked about are on those slides and photographs. So I priced it, you know, well, at $15 for each DVD to make it affordable to everybody. So please go to my site, fountainsofuse.net. You can see a picture of me, read my bio, and find out about all the research I've done over the years, and check out my DVDs. That would be really great. Now, in a few minutes, my co-host, Candy, is coming on. She's a psychic, intuitive, and normally she charges $100 an hour for a reading. Guess what? It's free. All right, so get ready to call in really soon. You know where the numbers are. They're on the main page of the website. So get ready with your questions and call her within about 5 minutes, okay? So in the meantime, we'll talk a little bit about the news of the day. I haven't actually watched any mainstream news or television for perhaps about 5 years now, since 9-1-1, since I believe the true story wasn't told about 9-1-1. And the big news this week on the Internet and the alternative sites is that E. Howard Hunt, one of the men who was in Dealey Plaza when JFK was killed, he was one of the three tramps, mysterious tramps, gave a deathbed confession to his son, which was put on tape, and it names all the names of all the people involved in the death of JFK. So I think it's about as close as we're ever going to get to the truth. And he mentions Lyndon B. Johnson and some CIA people and some Cuban assassins and a whole group. And it's an amazing tape to listen to. So please check out Infowars.com. If you go to Alex Jones' site, he has a copy of that. And that's really the big story that's been bouncing all around the Internet this week. And we really do live inside the Matrix and outside the Matrix. If you're still inside the Matrix, you get stories like, the trial of Phil Spector, some record producer who hasn't had a hit record in 30 years, but, you know, somehow we're all supposed to sit there and watch that on the news. Or you can go to alternative sites like Infowars.com or DavidIke.com or the ones on the main links on BBSRadio.com. And that's a pretty big story with this deathbed confession from one of the men who was right there at Dealey Plaza in 1963. When JFK was killed. And so many people believe that our government really has spun out of control since 1963, and this other group has kind of come along with a different agenda. And it's really interesting. Alex Jones has really infiltrated Hollywood. A lot of big stars and celebrities are watching his tapes and videos and really getting the truth. And Bruce Willis is one of them. He was a hard-right neocon, and he was exposed to Alex Jones' work on InfoWars, and he's given an interview this week in Vanity Fair, and he's talking about how JFK it wasn't a lone gunman, and a lot of big names in Hollywood. You're going to hear more and more of them coming forward with 9-1-1 truth, not just Rosie O'Donnell and Charlie Sheen, but there's many, many more. Believe me, and I can't name the names because they have to come out in their own time, but look out for that. You're going to be seeing more and more of this information. So pretty soon, Candy is coming on the show. I want to remind all of you that I'm also a tarot reader. I read by phone, and I really help people, become their best, function to the best of their abilities. So I do have live readings from my website, fountainsofyouth.net, and I'd love to talk with you for half an hour or an hour and help you find your passions in life and achieve your goals, and if you're on a crossroads, help you find the right path. So that's something you can check out on my website as well. So Candia was joining us any moment. We're Mondays live, 8 to 9, and I will go ahead and give out the phone number. It's 877-876-5227. And just within a few minutes, call in, not just yet, 877-876-5227. And going back to my guest, Zachariah Sitchin's spokesperson, Eric Parker, the ancient astronaut theory really burst on the scene in about 1967. Of course, the book Chariots of the Gods was a bestseller, and then it became a movie. It was really widely shown. It really, every once in a while, something breaks through the mainstream, and Chariots of the Gods, the documentary, really did. It was shown on PBS, and widely, tens of millions of people saw it. And I don't know, he was a pioneer that Eric was, completely accurate on things, but at least he got the ball rolling. And then in 1976, Zachariah Sitchin broke through with all of these modern translations of the clay tablets, which go back to 4000 BC, and that's what we were talking about tonight, how there used to be this other group on the planet and how they interacted with human beings. And a lot of the biblical stories are actually in the clay tablets, the Garden of Eden story and the flood story and the tale of Noah's Ark. They're all in these original clay tablets. So it's really important to go back to the source. And I would recommend reading Sitchin. Boy, he has about 20 books by now. I would start with the first one, The 12th Planet. And my DVDs are a pretty good summary to get you up to speed. My DVD, The Sands of Time, on my site. Fountainsofyouth.net. So those will get you up to speed, definitely. So David Icke was mentioned a few times during the interview. He's a very, brilliant man, actually. I've seen him speak. He speaks for 8 hours, and he'll be in Mount Shasta this summer if you get a chance to go see him in Northern California. It's a big metaphysical New Age community, and he speaks out there every summer. And his idea is that a one-world government is being created behind the scenes, a new world order, and a lot of secret societies are linking together, privately, like the Council on Foreign Relations, to create this new world order. So I really recommend reading one or two David Icke books, too. Probably his best one, I think, is called And the Truth Shall Set You Free. And actually, davidicke.com is on the main website. And he has news headlines every day that are just wonderful. He really digs into the true stories, and he's really outside the matrix and gives us a lot of the real information happening all across this planet. So Zachariah Sitchin's books and the David Icke books and are really good places to start if you're confused by the ancient astronaut theory. And it is overwhelming at first. Certainly the first year I was studying it was just all a blur, all these different names, Easter Island and Stonehenge and Baalbek and Angkor Wat and all of these ancient cities all around the world. It was just a jumble. But then gradually, as you get into it, you start understanding the various ancient cities all around the world, and you're able to recognize them and identify them, and they certainly were advanced. We had very advanced civilizations in Mexico, in South America, in China, in Persia, and in Egypt, among other places. They certainly had advanced language and mathematics and art and architecture that appears to be way before its time. And what Eric and I were really digging into tonight is that these six or seven ancient societies were really created by the Anunnaki, this other group who can be considered like our cousins or our older brothers who were on this planet first, before us. So that's what I recommend to really get up to speed on the ancient astronaut theory. We talk so much about it on our show. By the way, all the archives are free. I have about 30 archives up now, and you can go to that section of the website and check them out for free. Now I'm working on my third DVD. It's going to be more esoteric information. That's really what I specialize in. And I want to talk a little bit about Egyptian obelisks. Those are those very tall monuments. Some of them are over 100 feet high, and the Washington Monument is actually, a replica of an Egyptian obelisk. Of course, the Freemasons built many of those structures in Washington, D.C., and that's an obvious reference to Egypt right there. So there's actually one called the Aswan Obelisk, and it's over 120 feet high. And there's over 27 of them that are still standing today in Egypt. Now, they're very heavy. Some of them are 200 tons or 400 tons, but the biggest one is over 1,000 tons, which is over 200,000 pounds. And it's one solid piece, actually. It's not constructed of different pieces. And so somehow they were able to carve this out of the granite quarry. I mean, if you can imagine that type of job. And it appears from, studying the relics left behind, it's some type of lathing material, some type of advanced drilling or machinery that left real precision marks and corners was used to carve these obelisks out of the ground. And you can see all kinds of, pictures of them on the Internet. And so they were able to carve them and somehow hoist them up and move them into place. And remember, the stone quarry was oftentimes not located right next door to the obelisk. Many times it was several miles away. If you can imagine, moving that big of a stone that distance. And that's why Eric and I and many others believe that advanced technology was used. So that's one of my topics I'm talking about is the Egyptian obelisks in my new DVD I'm working on. And I'll also get into the Hall of Records. That's supposedly an ancient library that has all of the secrets going back to Atlantis. And the theory is that it was, or the legend is, that it was buried under the Great Pyramids of Giza and underneath the paw, the foot of the Sphinx. And actually, the psychic, Edgar Cayce, channeled this type of information, and that's what he believed, and he talked about in his writings. So the leading researcher in this field is Graham Hancock, and he went to Egypt, and he studied the Sphinx, and they found that it was very weathered, deep weathered patterns, and of course, it's a desert, and they believe that it's very old, going back to 10,500 BC. Much older than what the traditional explanation of it being built at 3000 BC is, and because of this great erosion. And he did use some seismographic machines, and they were able to find an empty chamber beneath the paw or the foot of the Sphinx. And that has yet to be investigated, but it's... And welcome back to Odyssey. This is our next segment of the show, and we have an intuitive that's going to have live readings. Welcome, Candia Sanders, my co-host.
Hi, Mike. How's it going tonight?
Great. Excellent. We've had some good calls over the last few weeks, and we really want people to dial in right now.
Absolutely. Do we have the number? I don't have the number right in front of me. I hope you do. I hope you're more prepared than I am.
It's on the main website. There's several numbers, of course, people can choose from, and I am getting it as we speak. What's been going on in the past week?
Oh, as always, life is great. I was just telling Don this, that what's really great from last week's show, several people called in, and I said, okay, I'm going to hold you accountable. Please email me and let me know what's happening. And I have heard from Diane two or three times now. I haven't heard from the other gentleman yet, but he told me he would, and he said he'd get in touch with me in a couple weeks, and I just love it. It's awesome, so I've written back to her, and so I want to thank all of those listeners who were spontaneous enough to call. So please call us here tonight. We've got 10 minutes or longer, depending on if people are brave and wild and crazy and are willing to.
Yes, the number is 877-876-5227. So, yeah, and that's the thing. You don't just work with people one time. It's really a progression, isn't it?
Oh, it really is. I mean, that's what's so much fun. I actually like it when I have the opportunity to work with people more than once, because then you can take it to the next level and the next level. And I've got several clients. Well, actually, I've got a lot of clients, but I've got several clients that have been so persistent and consistent about examining themselves to dig to the deeper layers and the levels so that they can become better. It's just incredible. You know, you said what's been happening over the past week. You know, it usually goes in cycles, and the cycles have been around inertia and apathy and lack of action.
How can we help that?
Yeah, because what happens is we end up, you know, stagnating and not moving forward, and so it becomes inertia. Now, inertia, to me, from my view, now I may not, you know, go along with Webster's, but my definition of inertia is more of absolute lack of doing anything versus a state of being. A state of being, you're in this connection and communion with the world around you, even though you may be in a state of motionlessness. Whereas inertia, to me, is you can be moving around and being about your life, your business, your job, your family, but still be in a state of inertia where you are not taking any kind of action whatsoever, where it's non-action, where you become apathetic about your life, and that's where people get stuck. And it was interesting, this is kind of this cycle. It's like, this is amazing. And it does that. You know, when I work with people, it goes in cycles where we're all mirroring each other. So that was been the most recent. But I have to share something with you. You might find this very fascinating.
Go ahead.
Totally different. This is a totally random thing. Again, we have so many minutes. For those who are listening, we'd love to have you call. Mike and I are here having fun, so please join us here on the show. Again, the number is 877-876-5227, so please give us a call here in Odyssey. The other morning, I take my morning time to reconnect. I don't do what I would say would be a typical meditation, but I kind of energize myself, my body, getting everything in alignment. And so I said, okay, I kind of threw it out to the universe. Okay, if there's something that you could show me of interest, you know, something that's special, give me some kind of new vision that I haven't even thought about. And so I wasn't awake and I wasn't asleep, right? And the vision that I got, the visual I got, was really awesome. I was looking at a computer screen as if I were on maybe a PowerPoint or going through all these different kinds of things, and I saw all of these honeybees. Now, for those who don't know, we're having a challenge on the planet right now with our honeybees disappearing.
Big time.
And the honeybees were all around this. They were as if they were landing on the computer, and then it was so electric that they just dispersed. And what it showed to me is what's happening with the honeybees is that they're, once they get away from the nest, there are so many frequencies now that are disrupting their patterns that they are losing their compass.
Oh, like cell phones and things like that?
Cell phones, electricity, jet waves, microwaves, harp, you name it. And it's all disrupting their patterns because who doesn't have a computer anymore? We're all on the internet all the time. Thank God, because
sure.
We're on the show right now because of it. I love this. However, we've got to figure out a way where we can tone down those waves, those frequencies, because it is literally disrupting the bees. So it's one of those things that if the scientists could be more aware of it, if they could somehow maybe work with magnetics around or magnets around their beehives, they might be able to change it because it would help create the frequencies and the grids on the planet, realign them for the bees to find their homes. Now this, I don't know if it's scientific, I could have this all random, but to me it's absolutely worth trying. In fact, after I got that, there is a woman that I know in the Oregon area that does beehives that I'm going to contact and ask her to try it.
Right,
so anyway,
because they pollinate their flowers, and the whole food chain is based upon that.
That's
so
right.
It's important.
This is really a big thing. So anybody that's listening that does do beehives or knows of anybody that does, suggest they try working with magnets. And the other thing about magnets, really talk to somebody who knows the north and south polarities on them, because there are different types of magnets out there, different strengths, and be willing to try them, you know, and I think the key on that would be to align it with north and south and make sure that the alignment of the magnets are still in alignment with the earth grid to help the bees find their way home. So this was a couple of days ago. I know it's totally random from working with people and issues, but I find it to be a very intriguing concept to look at just because it is an issue that's happening right now, but not only in America but in Europe. So,
absolutely. Yeah, what I wanted to mention, you were talking about clients and inertia. You know, you and I have both followed our passion, but that meant going our own way, right? It wasn't that we, you know, followed the beaten path. So that's what people need to do, right?
Absolutely. That's a really good point. In fact, I was talking to this woman today about this, is that you really sometimes have to measure it by what you have to give up. Sometimes what your passion is, and moving out of the inertia, you have to be willing to give up a few things to change your life to be able to follow that path. And it's not always easy, but it is absolutely worth it. Just like you have, you know, changed your life. I mean, you're the Southern California beach boy, and look what you've done. You've shifted everything because you followed your passion.
You followed what was
important to you.
It's kind of risk-taking, actually.
It is. You have to give up a lot. And a lot of times, that means that friendships will shift and change. Family may shift and change. Now, they'll always be your family, but they may not be in your ballpark, you know, and especially in the woo-woo world that we do live in, right? However, for those who are out there in regular life, you still, if you want to follow your passion and you've always thought that you really wanted to be with a dog groomer or you wanted to paint airplanes for a living, and, you know, like they did in the World War One, you want to put on these old stickers, I mean, whatever, is that you've got to be willing to jump out of the inertia and take the steps.
So I just get the feeling there's someone out there that needs to call in that really wants to follow their passion but needs a boost. So call 877-876-5227. And now we do have passions in our childhood, don't we?
Oh, and absolutely. If we were
get lost along the way.
Uh-huh. And that's what one of my premises with all my clients, go back to when you were a kid. What is it you really wanted to do? Did you want to be the astronaut? Did you want to be the firefighter? You know, I always wanted a magic carpet. That's what I always dreamt of. Magic wand and a magic carpet.
Because we play games when we're kids, and we fantasize all this stuff, and it's fun, and it's real. But then we forget it along the way, don't we?
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. and it's a matter of reconnecting with that part of ourselves to help change the, you know, where we are right now, which goes back to stepping out of inertia and apathy, because it's really easy to become apathetic. It's too easy to go into the same day-to-day routine. Another week, another month has passed by, and you look back and you're going, okay, so what has changed in my life over the past year, the last couple of years? And you look back and nothing has shifted, then you know it's time to step out of inertia and out of apathy, especially when you're just in the same status quo and you're on neutral, you're not happy. Not necessarily depressed or sad, but you're sure not progressively happy, mm-hmm. joyful.
Mm-hmm. Or people get into ruts, right? They get into a rut.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure all you see that a lot with your clients. I definitely see that with mine. You know, and we do, you know, it's easy to get in ourselves in a rut. You know, hold yourself accountable to say, no, I'm not going to do it this way anymore. It's like, I got to get out of this. You know, because then you can find yourself playing the same old cassettes in your mind, and it's time to stop them, pull them out, put in some new CDs. And, you know, I've already moved my windows, you know, in my brain, not Windows 2012. I think I'm moving up to Windows 2, you know, the 2020 version, you know, so I've got it
the latest.
Dialed. You know, we're going to project forward here. So we're up to date. Oh, golly. Well, it looks like we are almost out of time and no one has called. One more time. We can take it just one more time.
Yeah, now's your chance. What I'm going to do is sign off, and because I actually do some readings on Monday night, so I'm going to let
Well, thank you for staying with me.
But I'm going to let you talk a bit more, and then go ahead and sign off when you're ready. And then, you know, last chance to call in the next few minutes. This is your golden opportunity.
Yeah, that's right. And if not this week, if you're not brave this week, next week. So
I'm going to say goodbye, and then I'll let you sign off.
You got it. You have a nice night.
Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Again, one more time. Again, we had a caller last week at 9 o'clock. He was brave. It was awesome. Our number here at the Odyssey Show on BBS Radio is 877-876-5227. For those in the Northwest, you've probably been outside enjoying the sunshine that we haven't seen in, well, I think since August. So if you're not ready to jump on the phone, I can understand, except for it's getting darker, so you can be brave. If you are interested in finding out more information, please go to my website, which is www.candiasanders.com. Lots of great stories, testimonials, and information that is worthwhile in reading. It's got a lot of different definitions on terms if you're not familiar with different things. And it's just fun. It also has a list of my upcoming classes and shows that I'm going to be doing, as an example, this weekend here in the Northwest. If you live in the anywhere, actually, in Oregon, Washington, I've got people coming from as far north as Seattle and as far south as Eugene. I'm having a relationships class this weekend, and relationship primarily with yourself, because that's where all of our relationships begin, is with ourself. And if you've got a good relationship going with you, then it projects outward, because it really is all about you. It's all about me. It's all about you. You know, and sometimes you can finally say, it's enough already. I don't want to be about me. I'd rather blame everybody else. But in reality, it's all about you. So that's what the class is on this weekend. If you're at all interested, if you're in the Northwest, and it goes from relationship with yourself and moving out, extending into a loved one, a spouse, boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever, to your kids, if you have kids, your parents, to the work environment, to your community, to the earth. And so you're more than welcome to hop on my website and find out more information on that. Also have other classes coming up that I will share. I've got one coming up in July on stepping out of time that has to do with working with the time grid. So I'm teaching you, in essence, how to access all frameworks of time, so that you can move forward in time, backwards in time, as well as into other lifetimes, and how it pertains to you, and how you can then step out of time to make this concept of very short days work for you. We all get caught up in that. We get stuck in this, I don't have enough time, there's not enough time, and there are not enough hours in the day, and we can learn how to work with that and shift that through our perception. So that is a class in July. And then in August, I've got a class up on Mount St. Helens. I have one of my clients from Texas is actually committed to flying in today. to join us. I've got people coming from all over. It's going to be up on the south flank of Mount St. Helens, and we're going to work with nature spirits and elementals and the energy of Mount St. Helens and the volcanic energy, work with earth grids and how it aligns with our bodies and the megahertz of our bodies in relationship to the planet. And again, just like the bees, the polarities of the planet, North and South Pole, and how it then relates to our brain. As an example of that, when I work with people that have bipolar disorder, I can understand why the doctors look, they are labeled it that way. I, of course, am not a doctor. I don't look at it in those terms. However, when I see the brain in terms of the left brain, right brain hemisphere, the division between the two, I look at that as a compass and look at it as North Pole, South Pole. And with bipolar, it literally changes the compass and it ends up being east-west. So it's really important that we're in alignment with our brains, in alignment with the planet. And that's what this class is going to be about. It's going to be an all-day class up on Mount St. Helens, and then we're going to have a barbecue down on the lake at the base of the mountain. I've got a place up there. We can all have a barbecue. I've set it up. I've got a bunch of campgrounds in the area and cabins you can rent, little motels in the area. So I think it's going to be an awesome day for really working with the Earth. I want to make this the first of an annual type of an event that we can work with and line up with the chain of the Cascade Mountain Range, work into the Ring of Fire, and really start working with all the energies of the planet. So I think it's going to be an awesome day for those who might be interested. And it's looking like nobody's going to be brave tonight, so thank you for joining Mike and I here on the Odyssey Show every Monday night from 8 to 9 p.m. here on BBS Radio. We want to thank our host, Don, for doing such a great job for creating BBS for those of us out here who want to be able to share the information and knowledge that we have acquired over the course of our lives, and we want to thank him. So have an absolute beautiful and fabulous week, and we look forward to having you join us here next week on BBS Radio. Thanks, and good night.